From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This hour is about two pieces of critical infrastructure that have been in the news lately. First, the internet. A European group that tracks spammers has been getting nailed by a massive cyber attack. The attack plays on a vulnerability in the global systems that connect you with websites. We'll consider the future of internet security in our first half hour. Then in the second half, we'll focus on the new eastern span of the Bay Bridge. Construction crews recently found that more than 30 huge bolts in the span broke. But state officials say the problem can be fixed in time to open on Labor Day weekend. You'll hear from the head of the local agency overseeing the new bridge next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. It's a case of spamming the spam fighters, a cyber attack that points out just how vulnerable the internet really is. The target of this attack was Spam House, a volunteer group based in Europe that makes lists of problem servers. Hackers flooded Spam House with worthless web traffic in retaliation for adding a web hosting service to its blacklist. The attack happened at 300 gigabits per second. Now, by my calculations, that's fast enough to download the 12-hour Lord of the Rings Extended Edition trilogy from iTunes in 1.5 seconds. In this hour of Forum, we'll meet the San Francisco-based company that's helping Spam House recover from this tidal wave and consider how to keep the web safe and flowing in the future. Let's talk to Matthew Prince. He's the CEO of Cloudflare. His company has been working with Spam House to prevent the traffic surges that shut down its website. Matthew, good morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Also joining us is Kevin Mitnick, the CEO of Mitnick Security Consulting. Mitnick knows the dark side of the web all too well. He has been hacking into systems since he was 12, and he once was a fugitive on charges of hacking Pacific Bell's voicemail computers. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you for having me on your show.
We'd like to hear from you as well. What are your concerns about staying safe online? If you run a site that's been hacked, how did you handle it? And what could be done differently? Call us. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also comment on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. We are at KQED Forum. Matthew Prince, let me begin with you. What is the condition of Spam House right now? Have they recovered from this attack, or are they still kind of buckling under all of this worthless web traffic?
Yeah, Spam House has been available since March 18th when they contacted us and signed up for Cloudflare. And the attack itself stopped about 48 hours ago. That was the last major surge in traffic that we saw from the particular attackers. But we were able to, once Spam House was on our system, mitigate the attack, begin studying it, and really help them get their sites back online so they could help the internet continue to filter email.
Now, have I characterized this attack correctly? I think my math is correct in terms of the speed of it, but the nature of it, it basically is just hackers using other web servers to flood Spam House's website and their web connections with traffic that basically overwhelms them. Is that right?
Yeah, it's sort of the digital equivalent of the physical world. If somebody picketed your store or did a sit-in where they had a bunch of people go into a physical location and just fill it up with more people than were actually buying the legitimate whatever your store was legitimately selling. The analogy that I've just been keep coming back to over and over again for the last week has been, you know, the late Senator Ted Stevens talked about how the internet was just a series of tubes, and he actually got a lot of flack for that, but I always thought it was a really apt analogy. At the end of the day, the internet is just a series of tubes, and if a bad guy is able to fill those tubes up with so much traffic that the good traffic can't get through, then effectively that takes a website, or in some cases that can take parts of critical infrastructure actually offline for anyone else trying to access it.
Kevin Mitnick, let me put this to you. Considering this analogy of being just a big series of tubes, that must expose just how vulnerable the internet is in some ways. But for people who aren't real familiar with how all these tubes actually work, are these closed tubes, open tubes? Is this a highly protected system, or is it still pretty much wide open?
Yeah, it's pretty much wide open. You know, basically, you know, you have traffic going through, you know, these tubes, if you will, and these attackers have, you know, have lots of compromised servers, lots of compromised computers that are, you know, sitting in people's homes and offices, and they basically direct these computers to send traffic through these tubes, and a lot of traffic, so it basically clogs these tubes and makes it so legitimate traffic can't pass through. This has been around forever. It's really nothing new. I guess what's really new is the size of this attack. This has been around since, I think, the year 2000, when this teenager out of Canada did these denial of service attacks against major brands like eBay, Yahoo, and others.
Why is the system as open as it is? It almost sounds like having a neighborhood of homes where no one locks their doors or even has a door, for that matter. Why is the system this open?
This is how it was designed from the beginning. And basically, anyone could send, you know, it's just basically how the internet, you know, routes traffic. And it's just in the design. It allows traffic to go through, and this traffic is not throttled in usual cases, and it allows this type of stuff to happen.
Throttled meaning intentionally slowed down.
Correct.
So it basically, the nature of the internet requires that you just let everything flow everywhere in every direction as unimpeded as possible?
Well, yeah, but one of the big issues here is it's a technique called IP spoofing, and this is where an attacker could like forge traffic to make it look like it was coming from somewhere else, and because of this technique, these attackers could send packets of data to a victim and make it look like it's coming from somewhere else, or actually use other techniques where they send packets of data to what we call a DNS resolver, right, and basically send a packet of data and the recipient actually thinks it's coming from the victim, right, because the attacker is able to forge this information. So now when this device responds back with data, it actually goes to the victim, if that makes sense to you. So it's basically, that's one of the problems, is that these devices are sitting out there and they're not filtering traffic that is what we call spoofed.
Right.
It's too easy to forge the traffic to make it look like it's coming from anyone, and because of this, it makes it quite easy to do these attacks and make it difficult to trace the origin of them.
Right, Matthew, go ahead.
And I would say that by design, the internet actually throughout this attack proved itself fairly resilient. This was a very, very large attack that ended up slowing down portions of the internet throughout Europe and throughout Asia that weren't directly affected or related to Spamhaus or Cloudflare or the attackers themselves. But it was, it's pretty remarkable that packets continued to keep flowing even as ports were overwhelmed and there were other problems. What I think the thing that was unique about this, and the reason why, as Kevin was alluding to, the reason why these attackers have been able to achieve a scale of the attack which is heretofore unprecedented, is the fact that they have been taking advantage of two things. There are essentially two pieces that were necessary for the recipe to launch this attack. The first was, as Kevin referred to, the ability to spoof their identity online and pretend to essentially be the victim. This is something that more and more that people have known could potentially be a problem for quite some time, and more networks are adopting practices to be able to limit that. But until that is done network-wide, that opens up the possibility for attacks. And then the other problem is that there are these things called open resolvers, which are essentially misconfigured DNS servers that are running across the internet. And anyone who has a network or a business that's online should right now go to the Open Resolver Project, which is openresolverproject.org, and check if they have any of these running on their network. And if they do, they're almost certainly being abused by attackers to launch these very large-scale attacks.
And
so the way...
Matthew, I know our time is short this hour. I want to get to the law enforcement angle of this in terms of how we might prosecute these cases momentarily. But since we talked about the internet traffic piece of this, there's been some question in terms of just how big an attack this actually was. I know that there's been reporting from the BBC and the New York Times that says that it was, you know, the biggest internet attack in history, enough to slow down the internet. I'm sure that a number of people have found anecdotally that their web speed seemed to be slower. But yesterday, there was a report that came out from Sam Biddle of Gizmodo that questioned the notion of whether or not this attack even happened. There are a number of graphs and charts within it. He went through the Amazon web server data, which provides the backbone for a gigantic amount of the internet, and all of its indicators are green. Everything looks pretty good. So there seems to be some question now in terms of whether or not your claims about the severity of this were hyperbole or even true. How do you respond to that?
Well, if you look at a list like the NANOG list and what people have been talking about, which is the list of network operators around the world, they've been talking about this attack for the last 5 days as it's been going on, and there's been concern in regional networks that there is slowness and port congestion in those locations. What we saw against our own network was about 150 gigabits. Of traffic per second. The 300 gigabit number comes from one of the tier one providers that sits upstream from us, who's confirmed it to other reporters. The nature of the internet itself, we've never again claimed that this affected every internet connection across the world. What was interesting about this attack in particular, however, was unlike attacks that previously had been launched just against the intended victim, this attack actually went after the underlying core infrastructure of some of the places that hold the internet together. In particular, it went after what are called internet exchanges, and it focused primarily on internet exchanges in London, Frankfurt, and Amsterdam. And so while in the United States, there actually was almost no attack traffic. There was a significant amount of attack traffic, which was focused in Europe.
All right. Well, let's talk about the law enforcement angle of this. I want to bring in Edward Strauss. He's the co-president of Strauss Friedberg, a national digital risk management and investigations firm. Mr. Strauss is also a former FBI special agent who deals with internet extortion and denial of service attacks. Mr. Strauss, good morning.
Good morning.
So what does law enforcement do about this? The laws are different all over the world. Getting international governments to work together under the best of circumstances can be difficult. How do you actually prosecute these cases effectively?
Well, you raise a good point. Anytime the activity in question crosses international boundaries, it does introduce additional complication. However, they being law enforcement, have been dealing with investigations that involve those challenges for some years now. In this particular instance, you raise some very good points about conflicting information about even whether the degree of the severity of the problem is what it purports to be. There were conflicting information. This is where I think you need an investigation with expertise in this area. And the investigation is separate from the prosecution. So if the investigation is to get the facts and to see whether or not what is alleged to have occurred or appears to have occurred can be corroborated with factual information that comes from systems, from interviews, and to the extent that the trail leads you to another country, there will have to be a respectful legal process for continuing that investigation in the other country. And there may, in fact, be a law enforcement investigation in the UK or in the Netherlands or wherever else this may be happening. And it's important for the law enforcement authorities to be cooperative so that it is efficient and pursues the truth.
So to an extent, the FBI's ability to pursue this, if it does fall to the FBI, is really kind of limited by the law enforcement in whatever country this happened. I mean, if the spammers, the hackers happen to be in a country that has great relations with the U.S., does that mean that the case is going to be easier than, say, if they were in a much more closed regime?
Absolutely. One thing I can tell you, and I've worked with these people quite a bit, is that rapport between the organizations and between the law enforcement people in each country is enormously important in the success. Not to minimize the formal aspects of it, however, in order for an investigation to proceed in another country, Sometimes the FBI has a legal attaché presence there. They're FBI agents, but they have no authority to do any work on their own. All they can do is be the liaison to the local law enforcement people. And the most effective investigations internationally are ones where the American law that is being investigated has an equivalent counterpart law in the other country. So there's a degree of sort of reciprocity in place.
And briefly, Ed, how often do these prosecutions actually result in a conviction or even an arrest?
Most investigations do not lead to an arrest or a conviction, but part of serving justice is to investigate. If it turns out that the investigation either establishes that there is not sufficient evidence to charge somebody, or perhaps there's evidence but they can't really identify responsibly which individual was responsible, that investigative action still helped forward the quest for truth, even though the outcome is not exactly what I think the man in the street was expecting.
Gotcha. Thank you, Ed. That's Edward Strauss, the co-president of Strauss Friedberg, a national digital risk management and investigations firm, giving us the law enforcement angle of fighting cyber attacks. Ed, I appreciate your time. Thanks very much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let's get to a few of our listener calls and emails. Let me get to a few emails first. Lee writes, attacks like these depend on compromised systems such as outdated copies of Windows and poorly maintained mom-and-pop web servers. If the number of these botnet enablers were reduced, we would all be safer. Steve writes, if people would just turn off their Wi-Fi when they were not using it, spammers could not use their computers. One of the listeners wrote to our website, also skeptical of the claims from Cloudflare, quote, you have fallen for a Cloudflare press release. It is correct that this is likely the largest DNS amplification attack we've seen. However, it had zero impact across the internet except to Cloudflare, which is in the business of shielding companies from these attacks. And when they advertise their success in the national media, when they are successfully doing their job. David asks whether Cyber Bunker is still on the Spam House blacklist. I believe it is. Matthew Prince, can you answer that? Are they still on the blacklist?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
Okay. Let's take a call from Nicholas in Napa. Nicholas, good morning.
Hi. Thank you very much. My name is Nicholas Weaver. I'm a researcher at the International Computer Science Institute. One thing that I suspect is occurring is these DNS reflectors that are, in many cases, not actually open recursive resolvers, but simply old NATs, the home networking equipment that people use, because a lot of that, in my experience, has a bug where it accepts external requests and is therefore usable.
Now, when you say home networking equipment, you're talking to a guy who does not have a CS degree, so you're going to have to make this very simple for me. You're talking about like the kind of Wi-Fi routers that I could get at Best Buy?
Yes.
Okay.
Some of them, on the order of 1% to 2% in my experience, have a bug that allows them to be used for this style of attack.
So some of this is just old equipment that's being exploited over and over.
Yes, and if a user's equipment is being exploited, they will see that their network is slow, even if the rest of the internet is unaffected, because their connection ends up being clogged. And I suspect that some of the reports of the network seemed slow that occurred in the U.S. were because the people complaining their computers were, or their network was being part of the attack.
Gotcha. So the whole web might not have looked slowed down, but their little corner of it was being hijacked.
Well, they would see the whole web being slow, but only they would see the whole web being slow.
Gotcha. All right, Nicholas, thanks very much. Kevin Mitnick, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I'm not familiar with the exploit he's talking about where on a home router where that could be leveraged, but I understand, you know, what he's basically saying is if a consumer's network, well, a computer, let's say, on a consumer's network at home is compromised and it's sending traffic, it will be slow to that consumer. I mean, that makes a lot of sense because their computer is sending traffic unbeknownst to them under the control of the attacker. So that sounds reasonable. But as far as their router being compromised in 2% of the cases, I'm not familiar with that exploit.
Kevin, who's doing this? Is this just, you know, when we say spammers, are we talking about, I've heard reports, everything from some kid in his dorm room to the Russian mafia to, you know, the North Korean government. I mean, you always, it's a billion different pictures of who these amorphous spammers are. Do we have any idea who is actually behind this, generally speaking?
Well, this particular case, because this Dutch provider was listed on the blacklist and one or more people were upset about this, you have to look, well, who was benefiting from that, right? Who was being disadvantaged by being listed by SpanHouse, and look to, well, was because of this, was it were these people monetizing it? You know, so to me, you know, a reasonable guess would be it would be the people that were affected by being listed on the blacklist, and they were angry, and they did, and then they retaliated. That's what makes sense to me. Is it had in this case, it was because of monetization.
Gotcha. Matthew Prince, what do you make of the overall state of cybersecurity right now? I want to try to talk about some solutions and ways forward. I looked up one of the reports from Symantec about the volume of email spam just by itself in the World Wide Web, and it seems like the numbers have dropped from 97% of all email being spam to about 66% of all email being spam. So it looks like the overall, if Symantec's report is correct, the overall amount of this junk is going down. Is that what you see? And if so, to what might you attribute that?
I think that that's true, that the amount of spam being sent across the network is actually dropping. What's interesting is that what that does is that changes the business model of some of the bad guys online. So in, you know, early 2000, if you were a virus writer and you compromised a whole bunch of machines scattered throughout the internet, then the way that you monetized those machines was by renting them out to spammers. As spam filters have gotten more powerful and better at stopping spam, that business model is actually being challenged. And so now you have a whole bunch of compromised machines that the virus writers aren't able to lease out to spammers as much. And they're looking for other ways to essentially monetize that resource. And denial of service attacks like the one that was launched against SpamHouse are one of many business models that are emerging for that underground economy. And so we've seen as the rate of email spam has actually started to fall, as a percentage of overall email, the number of attacks and the size of the attacks in terms of denial of service attacks has gone up. There are other problems that those same botnets create, things like taking over bank accounts and stealing personal information. And those are all, again, just there's this resource that criminals have, and they're using that in any way that they can to find a way to monetize it.
And very briefly, in our last minute together, Kevin Mitnick, what would you say is the one best thing that businesses and consumers can do to protect themselves and to try to make the web a little safer from cyber attacks? Very briefly.
Well, I believe resolving the issue with the DNS resolving, going to the site that was mentioned before to resolve, to make sure you don't have an open DNS resolver out there that could be abused.
And Matthew, what's that website again, briefly?
It's the OpenResolverProject.org.
OpenResolverProject.org. Matthew Prince is the CEO and co-founder of Cloudflare Incorporated. Kevin Mitnick, the founder and CEO of Mitnick Security Consulting. Gentlemen, I appreciate your time. Thank you both for talking to us.
Thank you.
Time for a brief break. When we come back, we'll talk about the future of the Bay Bridge. Broken bolts found on the new Eastern Span. What will that mean for the bridge's opening on Labor Day weekend? Stay close. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.